Testing, testing, 1, 2. So it's 10:15. It's time to start the lecture. Do you want to come a little bit further to the front? I feel like you're avoiding me by kind of clumping together in the back. No one volunteers to move? No? Okay. So welcome to this fourth seminar. The agenda today, let's see. We have 2 hours of lectures in this room first, starting now, where we'll talk about incident response. And then we move into K105. And I continue lecturing about more advanced computer network defense. And I'll also go through some cases, case studies with you, and give you some stories about incident handling. And I have actually two Kahoot quizzes today. So one after the two first hours, and then another one at the end, which is why I bought two prizes for you. So let me see. So if you're lucky, you can win one of these. Before we start, I'm sure that some of you are working hard on your project work right now, and maybe you have some questions about the project work. So I'll start with that. Because your deadline is approaching. It's a little bit more than 1 month until you need to, or it's 1 month approximately until you need to submit, the 7th of April. So less than a month, sorry. You have all delivered your drafts, which is good. And the student assistant has gone through all the drafts and made some comments for you. For the bachelor students, for the master students, I still have a little bit of backlog in reading through everything, so you will have to be a little bit more patient, but I try as soon as I can to give everyone feedback. Also, I want you to give each other feedback on your drafts. So I want you to have a group that you can exchange drafts with. So to make this easy, I've already uploaded a description of who is evaluating each other's drafts in the Fronter room. So there's a PDF there. You can find the names of all the groups with all the names of people in them and which group you are exchanging your draft with. And the same goes for the master students. Not so many master students this year. If you're not on the list, please send me an email, because then I have not gotten your draft, and you need to submit your draft in order to get the grade, which counts for 50% of the exam. If you fail the project work, if you do not deliver anything in the project work, you will also fail the whole course. So just a warning. If you don't find your name on this list, please send me an email. Has anyone got any questions about this? So the deadline is the 7th of April. Please try to do your best to catch the deadline. I'm sure you have other things to do before the end of the semester too, so better be done with the deadlines as they come. I sometimes get emails from students that feel that they cannot reach the deadline, and you need to have a very good reason to get a delay. Okay? But of course, if someone in your family dies, or there's some really good reasons that you should get a delay, please just send me an email about it and we'll sort it out. No questions about the project work? Is everything okay? You know that you can also get some help from the student assistant if you have questions about the project work. Yeah, one question. Deadline for? So the evaluation should be done as soon as possible, because you need, or it will be helpful for you to get the feedback as soon as possible from the other group. So I encourage you to contact the other group or the other person as soon as possible and exchange your drafts, and then you decide when you need to have this feedback ready. When you submit the project work, you also should submit your self-evaluation at the same time. There's a separate box in front here that you can fill out your self-evaluation. So that should also be ready when you submit. Okay? That's true, but it's in your own interest, I think, to do it. So it's helping each other out. So it's voluntarily, yes. It's not something I will monitor and see if you actually do, but it's a good way of getting someone to look at your draft and give you their opinions. And also as a way to practice the self-evaluation, because you get to evaluate the other group's work and give them a grade in this process, and that's a way of also practicing giving yourself a grade. And remember, your self-evaluation also counts towards your grade, but not the evaluation you do of the other group. Is everything clear? No more questions? Of course, if you have further questions, send me an email or come to me in the break and discuss. Okay, so I wish you all good luck with the project work. I know it's kind of hard work. It's a lot of pages to write, but you learn a lot in the process. And it's a way of actually doing some practice of what you're learning in this course. But today we'll focus on incident response, which is the core content of this course, in my opinion. So we'll look at this phase after you have had an incident, you have done all the analysis and detection, and you came to the point where you decide this is a real incident, and now we start doing the incident response. So what's the first thing you need to do when you start doing incident response? You should have a strategy. And there are different strategies depending on your own capability, your own capacity, and also depending on the type of incident, of course, and the opponent that you're facing. Protect and forget is one strategy. That's a strategy where you figure out what's going on, you find what caused it, or you see the symptoms of the incident, you reinstall, you get your network up and running again, and then you just move on to the next case, next incident. This is typically what you would do if you have like very frequent small incidents that are not really that damaging to your organization, and where you feel confident that you know the root cause, and you don't suspect that there's something deeper hidden, some backdoors hidden in a network that you can't find, and you have a clear idea of what type of opponent is doing this to you. So if it's like common type of viruses and cyber criminals that are behind this. watchful waiting, that's another type of strategy where you decide that you want to learn more from the adversary, learn more from the attacker. So you have discovered that you're under attack, you have discovered that someone is intruding into your network, but you choose to try to not notify the attacker that they have been discovered, and you try to monitor them and learn from what they're doing on your network and on your systems. And then you have the third strategy, which is apprehend and prosecute. That's when you have a clear idea of who is behind, you have enough evidence, you're starting to collect evidence with the goal of actually prosecuting someone for the crime. The problem is, when do you know enough about this intrusion? When can you decide if you want to just try to evict the attacker and deny the attacker re-entry to your network? There's a fine balance point there. You're collecting information and you're learning from what's going on your systems, and then you have to make a decision at some point. Should we start cleaning up and hence notifying the intruder that they have been discovered, or should we keep cool and sit back and watch this going on and learn more about what's happening? So that's kind of, it can be very nerve-wracking to be in charge of making this decision. And of course, it all also depends on your own ability to be able to monitor, to be able to understand what is going on. Most organizations don't have this. They will just be in crisis and panic when they discover they have been breached. If they don't have a plan, if they don't have a team, you cannot do the watchful waiting. You just have to start doing something to try to protect yourself as good as you can. So remember that depending on what's going on, it's not always that the goal of incident response is cleanup. Sometimes the goal is to learn to do threat intelligence, threat analysis, and then use your collected information to actually don't make this happen again to your network. So what is a typical timeline of an intrusion? So there's a stage before anything happens, that's the reconnaissance phase, where the attacker learns from your from probing or from other open sources about you, and they make a strategy, a plan of how to break into your systems. And this, of course, can take a while. So this is a timeline where you have first a reconnaissance phase, and this could be like days, weeks, months, even years, depending on how determined the attacker is in gaining entry into your system. So they will plan carefully how to do their cyber operation in this phase. And in this phase, you will most likely not be alerted about that something's going on. But you might be able to also detect that something suspicious is going on in this phase. And then you have the intrusion. And this is when the intruder actually enters into your systems, breaches your network defenses, and gains access. And what happens next? Cleanup? Incident response? No, it's usually it's a dwell time. It's a time when someone has breached your systems, your networks, and you are completely unaware of this. You don't know that this has happened. So the intruders, they have plenty of time usually here to gain more access, to move laterally inside of your network, plant backdoors, and start maybe also doing exfiltration of information and cleaning up after themselves and so on. So this is the time where you should be alert and hopefully not use as long as over a year to discover that you have been breached. So this number is from a report by computer security company Mandiant, but this is some years ago. I've seen some newer reports from them where they have actually managed to, by looking into all the intrusions they have been investigating, this number has actually decreased, which is a good thing. So this is something you should measure and try to keep a metric of if you have a lot of intrusions. And then you detect that something is going on, the detection. And that's when the incident handling starts. So I show you this because I want you to be aware that the incident handling starts at the point where a lot of damage could already have been done. And that means that just cleaning up, reinstalling all the computers, and then think this is fine, is not always the best strategy. So it all depends on the type of incident and how long they have been into your networks and how certain you are that you actually are able to get rid of them. So in the book, so then you are in the point where you can ask yourself, is this cleaned up? I see that the slide is kind of blurry there. Sorry about that. So in the book, these different types of strategies are described step by step. I don't know if I'm going to go through all this in detail because you can read it in the book. And that's the protect and forget and the apprehend and prosecute. But the watchful waiting strategy is not that good described in the book because that's a strategy that is mostly used for more advanced, sophisticated type of threats, which have not been that thoroughly covered in the book. So I'll elaborate more on that in this lecture. And I point you to other resources of information, like the one paper about the kill chain model that I want you to read before this lecture. So this is kind of step by step what you can do, depending on what strategy you choose. So protect and forget, apprehend and prosecute. You can read this in the book. And this is a very long cycle, because if you do the apprehend and prosecute version, you need to be very thorough with collecting evidence, because that's the strategy you use when you want to prosecute someone. And that's also the way the strategy or the type of incident handling, where you'll get in contact with law enforcement, and you need to follow strict steps in order to have forensically sound evidence. It's something called chain of custody that the forensicators are very thorough with. It means that when you collect evidence, it's very important to be sure that no one has been tampering with the evidence. So that's when you first have evidence, you need to maintain a log or some kind of paperwork in order to prove that no one has been able to do something to tamper with the evidence. So for instance, if you have a disk image, you could put it in a seal-proof bag on a disk, and then whoever is in contact with this or handles it in a way needs to sign off on the paper and needs to have a complete log of everyone that had access to it. So that's a typical thing you should do if you want to work with law enforcement and actually prosecute someone for cyber intrusions. Okay, so you have decided on a strategy. The alarm has sounded and you're now in incident handling mode. What's the first thing you do after you decide sort of what's our approach to this incident? Of course, you need to notify everyone that's supposed to be handling the incident, because you probably have a team of people that should be called in if this is outside office hours or if you just need reinforcements to be able to handle a big incident. So this is something you should have thought about beforehand, before the incident. How to notify your people, who to notify, and to just have a good way of notifying them. For instance, by sending out SMSs to predetermined lists of people and calling them into office. Or have one person just calling everyone on a list. But then you need to decide who to call first and who to call last. And usually you will have a kind of hierarchy or sequence of how to do this. And also you should think about beforehand what to put in your alert message so that it's clear to everyone involved what are their tasks and why they're called in. Not just red alert, come into the office. Or if it's red alert, then it should have notified beforehand so people know what red alert means and how like a code name have somewhere have a knowledge of what the different code words mean if you don't want to explicitly put in plain text in your message if you want to use some kind of code words. And of course not everyone should be on the alert roster, and it should be updated, tested, and maintained like all the other documents involved in incident handling. And also something you should do straight away, like the next step, is working on documentation, documenting the incident. It's not something you do afterwards. You need to do it while you're working on doing the incident handling. And this is very important because then you will be able to study the incident afterwards and see what actually went on. It's good for management and it's good for team leaders to always have an updated note on where we are now. Who is involved, what has happened, where did thing happen, and why should maybe be the last question on this, because that's usually not something you know from the start. So why is maybe the last thing you should worry about in this stage. And then, as I mentioned, if you want to have a good cooperation with law enforcement, you need to maintain a documented chain of custody of the evidence. And as I've already been through, you also need to have an incident containment strategy, not just like a plan for how to handle the incident. How do we contain this incident? How do we stop it from spreading further? How do we protect other systems that we think are not affected yet? And so on. So the first thing is, of course, to identify how big parts of the system is affected. And then you need to do this with really fast. Speed is of essence in this stage. So you do not have the time to do really thorough analysis at this point. Usually forensics would take too long to do at this stage, but there are some automated tools that you can use to speed this up. So of course you should focus on stopping the incident and recovering control of your affected systems. But this is if you do not take this watchful waiting strategy, of course. If you do the watchful waiting, you should not do any active incident handling measures, because that would probably notify the attacker that they have been discovered. So focusing on how much is affected and how to, for instance, segment and isolate those affected parts of your systems from the parts that are not been affected yet. And there are tools that you can use also to detect lateral movement inside of a network, for instance, that could be very useful in this at this stage. So how do we contain an incident? Of course, this could be by shutting down everything, but probably you're not allowed to shut down all the IT systems because this would be really damaging to your company's income. But usually you will have some, depending on how you have, how the system architecture look like, how your network architecture look like, you can disconnect maybe parts of it and isolate some parts. You could also do some reconfiguration, for instance. You can block traffic. You can stop services, disable processes, take down some servers, maybe not all. But you might need to stop everything in order to contain the incident, which will be, of course, a kind of dramatic thing to do and something that you need to have leadership signing off on. But I also want to point out that it's really important that the team manager in charge of doing the incident response should have enough authority to be able to make this type of unpopular decisions, because otherwise you will have too much bureaucracy to be able to move fast and make the important decisions that you need to. So sometimes you need to really escalate an incident. If it's a big thing going on, you might need to hit the panic button. You might need to involve other plans than your incident response plan, like a disaster recovery plan. And you might also need to just say, we give up on handling this incident, it's too much for us. We hire in some other parties to do it, or in some cases, actually government or authorities step in and take over the incident handling. And it's transferred to some outside authority. And criteria for when to escalate, when to invoke different types of plans should be described in your incident response plan. Okay, let's use some time for you to discuss among yourselves, so I don't talk all day long. I want you to talk with the person next to you about these questions. So, you are a C-cert team leader in a company. You're producing chemicals. Your team just received a notification from the national cert that several clients inside your company may be compromised by an espionage threat actor. The initial network log analysis shows suspicious traffic from the company's proxy server to an IP address associated with the infrastructure commonly used by this threat group. So first thing to discuss is what incident response strategy would you use in this case. The second is, let's say that you use the watchful waiting strategy. What are the dilemmas you would face in using this tactic? So 5 minutes for you to discuss, and then I want to then I'll ask you afterwards for your input, and we'll do that in class. Okay, you're done discussing. So let's use the last 10 minutes to discuss this a bit in the class. So what did you discuss? Yeah, what did you decide on question 1 and 2? So you would add on the protect and forget.
Stop them from seeing more than they already have seen. Just stop them out and maybe figure out how they got in and stop it from happening.
So why did you decide on that stopping them was the most crucial part? Yeah, so your conclusion is that since it's a very serious incident, yeah, and maybe this could be damaging to national security, you need to focus on getting rid of the intruders. Okay. So let's say that you used the watchful waiting strategy. What would have been your dilemmas? Yeah, so to find that point where you have gathered enough information about the intruder to feel confident that you now know enough about them to stop them. Mm. But that could also be an argument to the first question, because usually if you have a really advanced attacker, they know much more about you than you know about them. So if you just start trying to evict them straight away, you might not know enough about the intrusion to be able to fully evict them. And that's when you're in a situation where they might still be persistent in your network and you did not actually get rid of them. But you believe that you got rid of them. And that's also dangerous when it comes to espionage. Okay, how about the next group? What did you discuss? Okay. So do you think that in an espionage case you likely to find the identity of the intruder?
More or less, I think the
you think so? Yeah, usually it's kind of hard to find the real identity. It depends on what you mean by identity. If you mean the identity is a kind of signature of what this type of group of attackers is usually doing, that could be something certainly that you should take into account. But the real person or the operator behind is very rarely that you will get into. And that's why also in a lot of espionage cases it's no use in doing the apprehend and prosecute, because you're most likely you will not be able to prosecute anyone from this. Okay. You got any more input on the dilemmas you will face?
No.
Okay. But you two?
We went for the work from banking tactic.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So they will just change everything you already know about them and get into the system. So I would work for banking because they'll see and they probably already have all the information they need.
What would you do with the information you gather while you're doing the watchful waiting?
Depends on what information you are able to gather.
Mm-hmm. How about you two in the back? More aggressive approach, okay? Yeah. It's not so easy to find the identity of who's actually behind in lots of cases. But you could do it. There are some examples of it that you have police work across borders, and usually through Europol or some of the other police collaboration networks, where if you gather enough evidence and you have sort of pinpoint the attackers to a country that the police collaboration has some jurisdictions over, then it's possible in the end to actually apprehend someone and prosecute them. There are some cases where this has been successful, but it really takes a long time and it depends on police collaboration across borders. But of course, when you collect evidence, when you collect information, if you share this then with the authorities, it's possible in the end to maybe succeed in that strategy. How about you? Protect and forget. Okay, so not everything's been said already, okay. How about you, trio there? Have you discussed anything that we didn't go through yet? What strategy did you choose? So I apologize to those of you on the stream if you didn't hear the last 15 minutes of the last lecture, because I figured out the batteries had run out on my microphone. This should be all set again. So let's talk about actually doing incident response and how to handle different types of incidents. I'm not going to go through all types of incidents in this lecture because that's going to be too much. But I'll focus on how to handle denial of service attacks and how to handle malware attacks. So two of the most common types. But you can read in the textbook about different types of ways of handling other types of incidents too. For instance, insider attacks or other types of incidents. And then after the break, when we move to the other room, I'll focus on how to deal with APT style intrusions or advanced persistent threats and more advanced espionage, cyber espionage operations. But let's talk a little bit about the denial of service incidents. What should you do before the denial of service incident? Anyone have any good ideas? What you should do to prepare yourself for handling a DDoS attack? No one? No clues about what you should do? What did you say? You said something? Have enough server capacity? How much server capacity do you think you need in order to handle a really large DDoS attack? You know the magnitude of the latest biggest DDoS attacks that have been going on the last few years? No, that's not really realistic. But good attempt. because there have been like DDoS attacks where you have had packets incoming in the rate of like 600 gigabytes per second, which is really a lot of packets. Yeah. Avoid to have a political statement. Yeah, that's one way of kind of avoiding to be DDoSed. but of course, there are lots of reasons that some will decide to attack you. But of course, you can try to avoid it by not being too controversial in a way. Other things? You can have a service. Yeah, that's it's possible to pay for DDoS protection services. For instance, Cloudflare is one of the providers of that. They work in a way that they have. You will have a very large infrastructure like a CDN that is kind of protecting you upstream. So you will have a possibility of stopping or filtering out traffic at a higher level. And then also they will have load balancers and different types of techniques they can use to get rid of the traffic or to prevent clogging of the pipes, or how to say it. So there are lots of things you can do. You could, first thing I would say is to coordinate with your service provider, your internet service provider. Because usually if you're the victim of a DDoS attack, you will be overwhelmed. You cannot handle it yourself. You need to go one step further up in the infrastructure, or further up, depending on how large or how bad the incoming traffic is. Also, you should keep in mind, it's not always the volume of traffic that constitutes a DDoS attack. You can also have other types of DDoS attacks that, for instance, exploit vulnerabilities on layer 7 or other types of vulnerabilities you might have in your infrastructure in a way so that you get incapacitated, so you don't have any capacity left because your services don't work anymore. So you should First of all, coordinate with your service provider. Yeah, question. Yeah, the internet service providers are doing a lot to protect their own networks because they don't want to have collateral damage to their customers. So they're all the time handling DDoS attacks and other types of network outages, of course. So this is part of their way of keeping their customers satisfied. So they might not care if you're a very small customer and there's not a lot of collateral damage to their other more important customers, depending, of course, on the how serious also the internet service provider is to actually give assistance to their clients. But it's good to know who your internet service provider is and to have a contact point with them that is easy to find in the heat of the moment when you're suddenly under attack. So you should have a way of contacting your service provider at least. And you might also purchase services like DDoS protection, which can be quite costly though, from your service provider. And then collaboration and coordination is a big part of handling bigger types of incidents like DDoS attacks. Because usually you're not the only victim. There are examples where lots of organizations have been hit by the same DDoS attack or by collateral damage because someone else that is important to them have been hit by DDoS attacks. Like, for instance, the DIN DNS provider that was hit last year, in fall last year. That affected a lot of other companies. So you need to know who to collaborate with and who to coordinate with, and also with professional response agencies like CERTS, for instance. So CERTS do a lot of DDoS remediation and handling of trying to cleaning up, for instance, the bots that are commonly used in DDoS attacks. And then you can implement some prevention technologies. Of course, you should monitor your resources and also coordinate your capabilities in monitoring and doing analysis. Because one of the first things you should do when you're hit by a DDoS attack is to try to analyze what type of attack is this, where is it coming from, and that is the baseline in how to prevent against it, how to protect yourself against it. And that means you should have some meaningful logging and documentation. So you should have logs, and you should have a way of accessing your logs, and you should have a documented way for analysts to quickly get access to logs and know how to analyze them. And of course, you can also be careful in configuring your network devices in a way that minimizes your exposure to DDoS attacks. And also, you can configure your devices in such a way that you're not a participant in DDoSing someone else, which is often the case when you have reflective attacks that are reflected off of others' infrastructure. And this is often due to bad configuration of network devices or devices that are on the internet, like Internet of Things devices, for instance. And you could, of course, be preparing yourself by trying to stress test your services and find your shortcomings and try to fix it. And avoid being part of the problem, as I mentioned. Try to scan regularly your network. There are also some projects and researchers that are doing this all the time, scanning the internet, finding misconfigured or bad devices that are set up in such a way that they can be misused in a DDoS attack, and then alerting the ISPs, and the ISPs can then again try to get their clients to clean up the networks. But this is a really hard work, and it's very hard to get rid of all the misconfigured devices and abusable services on the internet. So we can feel a bit hopeless to be doing this, because it's really hard to get people to fix this problem. I don't know if you heard about BCP 38, Best Current Practice 38. That's a way of actually preventing spoofing of packets on the internet, which is a very big reason that you have a lot of types of DDoS attacks. The problem is that there's a lot of networks out there that don't actually do scan or make sure that the packets leaving their network have the right source address. So if everyone had implemented BCP 38 and everyone had made sure that all packets that are leaving my network have the correct source address, then we could fix spoofing, IP spoofing. But the problem, of course, that not everyone does this is a little bit like vaccination of the internet. If just some parts of it doesn't do this, then we still haven't fixed the problem. Okay. So you can also deploy anti-spoofing on all your network edges, if you implement BCP 38. So I mentioned that there's a lot of big DDoS attacks that have been plaguing the internet the last few years. That is because of common reflection and amplification vectors. So there are a lot of protocols out there that can be abused to make the device's reflectors in a DDoS attack. That means that you cannot find the real source of where traffic is coming from unless you hop back several steps in a network. And that's something that usually is very hard to do. And it requires a lot of collaboration between different networks providers. But these are just some of the protocols that are typically sending UDP packets, and UDP packets can be spoofed. And once you can spoof your source address, you can pretend to be someone else, and that's how you can sort of hide yourself in this attack, but also it's a way of fooling other services into sending packets back. You say that you want them back to you, but you're actually pretending to be the target. That's the basis of a reflection attack. And the amplification factor is because typically these type of protocols will send you a much bigger reply than your original packet. So if you send a small packet to this device, for instance, a small DNS lookup request, and then you will get a response that is much bigger. And of course, if you manage to spoof your origin to the attacker of the packet, or the attacker, to the victim that you want to attack, then you can get all these much bigger packets sent to your victim. And if you have a lot of devices, like if you have access to a botnet, then you can get all these devices at the same time asking for big replies, and the replies don't go to the devices, they go to the victim of the attack. So that's the basis why we have problem with amplification and reflection attacks. So these are some of the protocols that are commonly misused in DDoS attacks. And you can see that the potential of some of these protocols is really huge. They send you a huge response back. I don't know if you know all these protocols, but for instance, this is kind of obscure, but it sends you lots of... It's a protocol that has been, I think, used for kind of testing purposes. It will send you character. It's a character generation protocol, so it just generates a lot of characters and sends this back. And of course, this looks very strange in your logs if you look into logs after a DDoS attack of this. And you can also customize what type of reply they can send out, and you can sort of put your message into this reply. Any questions about how the DDoS attacks works? It's clear? So what should they do when you're a victim of these types of attacks? So first detecting it should be pretty straightforward. You usually know that you're a victim of a DDoS attack. But what's the containment strategies? That's really important here. Of course, you can shut off your network connection. But of course, this might cause more damage and damage to other parties. And sort of that's the goal of the attacker, is to make your network not available. So you're sort of fulfilling the attacker's goal by doing this. So that's maybe the last thing you want to do. Of course, you can look into your logs and figure out where is all this traffic coming from. Where is all the harmful traffic coming from, in case it's not a DDoS attack by numbers, but by more targeting your resources. It might be difficult, though, to figure out this, especially if you have spoofed sources. You can have like randomly generated source addresses, and you will have lots and lots of different types of... it's coming from all over the place, it will look like. You could, of course, try to fix the source problem. And this is typically if some of your services is being attacked. Let's say that you have a website, and on this website you have a search function. And there's a vulnerability that allows this search function to be exploited by an attacker, for instance, trying to search for things all the time. And this will then block your, make your resources go crazy, and nothing's happening. So easy way to fix that type of attack would be to just disable the search function altogether, and then you don't have that being exploited. Of course, you can have a filtering strategy, and you can change your filtering strategy based on typical things you can see in the log that is kind of signature of the traffic that is coming from the attacker. So if you're able to search your logs, beware that sometimes a DDoS attack can make it very hard for you to even access your logs if you haven't set up this correctly. But if you're able to see into your logs, you can see if there's a pattern in the malicious traffic, and then you can make a filtering strategy to try to get rid of this traffic. That can be typically based on these characteristics of the attack. And then, as I already mentioned, engage your upstream partners. If you're completely overwhelmed, nothing is working, you can't really do anything, then you need to go upstream to try to fix it. And your upstream partners might go upstream also from their point of view in order to fix this. And you could, of course, if the target system is a smaller part of your network or a smaller part of your system, you can maybe survive without, for instance, having this web page up and running. And then you can just get rid of, or just eliminate that part, and then rest of your network will survive. Sometimes you can try to maybe use different IP addresses for your services, but that's often a kind of strategy where you will play whack-a-mole, where you sort of change your IP address, and then the attacker figures out you're new, and then you will sort of have to switch around, and maybe not the best solution. So lately we have had problems like this. I'm sure you remember this from last year. It was actually an IoT botnet that was behind this huge, as far as I know, the biggest DDoS attack so far. So DIN is a DNS provider, and DIN had a lot of really important clients like Twitter, Spotify, Netflix, Reddit, and so on. So when DIN was victim of a DDoS attack, all of this, big providers went down. And for parts of the US, it was almost like the whole internet was down, even though that was not the case. But so many parts of the internet that people relied on didn't work, as you could feel that the internet was down. If you want to know more about this attack, There's a couple of articles that I linked down there. But it was basically an attack that was using both malicious TCP and UDP traffic over port 53, which is the DNS port. So they were misusing. It was a DNS traffic attack. And the origin of this was kind of interesting because it was the Mirai botnet that was behind it. And the Mirai botnet is a botnet that scans for Internet of Things devices with default passwords that are particularly, that was from one Chinese provider, a lot of internet cameras, DVR recorders and surveillance cameras that had this firmware with a factory set default password that was really hard to reset. And the Mirai botnets were just scanning the internet for these devices and incorporating them into the botnet by replacing the firmware on them. And it was really hard to patch this and really hard to sort of get rid of this botnet. And when this botnet was used in this DDoS attack, it became really huge. I was so lucky to be at the presentation last year where DIN was talking about how they actually did their incident response when they were hit by this big DDoS attack. There were some headlines saying that this DDoS attack is the biggest yet, and it's 1 terabyte per second traffic. But later claims that this was not as bad as first reported. And it's really hard, actually, to quantify the size of a DDoS attack. It's more in the area of 600 gigabyte per second, which we also seen in some other DDoS attacks before. But I don't know if you can read this. It's a little bit blurry, sorry. I think you can see it in the PDF of the slides. This is a photograph of the slides of DIN's presentation. So this is what they had to do in their kind of zombie apocalypse model of thinking about how this DDoS attack worked. They need to have plans to identify all of the infected devices, plans to deal with this swarm or herd of problematic Internet of things. And it's not only these cheap Chinese devices that are in the cameras, but they're also like in routers, and yeah, it's really a mess. And what they learned from this is that you actually need to have a good collaboration, integration between your security team, your network team, your development team, and everyone should be in the same, not exactly the same room, but they need to have some meaningful collaboration in order to deal with this. Monitoring is really essential, and analytics, so that goes into knowing how to actually analyze your logs and figuring out what is causing the problem. And also, you can use IP reputation combined with machine learning algorithms and so on to try to filter out traffic. Also, scrubbing traffic, they found out it wasn't enough. So that scrubbing traffic is what these big providers that offer DDoS remediation services does. But if it's so huge, you might need to black hole parts of the traffic, but problem is that this can have unintended side consequences, as they said. So it's really a problem that everyone is independently trying to rediscover a same bad actor list endlessly, and this is sort of discussing the problem with cleanup of botnets and badly configured devices. It seems like an endless problem where search and researchers are scanning for infected or misconfigured devices, sharing information, and then it's kind of endless problem that these things actually don't get fixed and don't get updated. So we need to actually work on this problem more as a community and not have like separate different initiatives handling it. Okay, I think I talked enough about DDoS attacks now. Any questions about DDoS attacks, incident handling, remediation? Okay, let's then focus a bit on malware incidents. So what should you do before a malware incident? You all know what a malware incident is? So when you have some malware on your systems, that should not be there. What should you do before this happens to you? Antivirus, that's and also up-to-date antivirus is important, of course. Update and patch systems, yeah. So if you update, you will be protected, but not protected against zero days and things like that. So you will get rid of most of the most common malware. More? Okay, let's see what I have here. Informing users. That's first on the top on my list. Awareness programs. So it actually helps to educate users. I don't know if you believe this, but some IT people think that users are generally just stupid and cannot be helped. but there's evidence that it's actually possible to make people change behavior. But it's not easy. And there's always someone that clicks. So if you have awareness programs, if you educate users and try to make users not click on things, it's not enough. But it's part of solving some of the problems. You need to be updated on what's going on. So if you have an incident response service or someone that is doing incident response in your organization, you should keep updated on what's the latest malware trend and what should we look out for now. Because this comes in waves. Intrusion detection prevention systems may help you in this. And this one is really important. Effective inventory and data organization. Sounds really boring, but that's actually very important. If you want to patch your systems, you need to know what systems you have. And you need to know their patching status at all times. And this requires a lot of inventory management. And this is actually the problem that we've seen the last year in a lot of hospitals. Hospitals have been hit by ransomware. In some cases, they actually had to shut down departments and turn away patients because they could not access the systems due to this virus. It turned out that a common problem that was the root cause of many of these infections were that they hadn't updated some software libraries that were used in JBoss. And the problem in hospitals were that they didn't really have good enough inventory management to know their patching status and know what they needed to patch in their systems. So this could have really big consequences. Also, it's important that you implement and test your data backup and recovery programs. Talking about ransomware, the advice is not to pay the ransom. So you shouldn't be paying bitcoins to criminals in order to gain access to your files, which the media reported that several of these hospitals did, actually, because they didn't have good enough backup programs. They couldn't roll back and get back in business again without actually paying bitcoins to criminals. And this is, of course, what sustains this and makes this a bigger problem. So to not be part of the problem, you should not pay the ransom. Use antivirus software. There are some researchers that are advocating against antivirus and saying that antivirus is evil and you should not use it. And that's partly because there in also we know in the last few years, I guess, that a lot of antivirus products come with inbuilt vulnerabilities that also can be exploited. But that's not an argument to not have antivirus. But of course you should not have the fake antivirus installed, which is a big problem, which is kind of malware disguised as antivirus, which is really common. You can also block suspicious files to prevent distribution of certain file extensions, or you can or this is also called whitelisting. It's really effective, but can be really hard to implement and be really painful for your users. It means that the users cannot install whatever type of files they have in whatever types of directory they want, and some files are banned and so on. But this is something that prevents a lot of malware from... you can get the malware on the system, but it won't really execute and be properly installed. And of course, filter unwanted email traffic, because the source of malware infections is very often that people click on things that come in an email, like a link or an attachment. And also, this is more in order to prevent exfiltration of information. You can minimize file transfer capabilities or detect or flag suspicious file transfers. Of course, eliminate, prohibit file sharing and pin sharing. Also, if I go back to the ransomware problem, a lot of ransomware viruses are built in such a way that they search for open file shares that you have access to, and if they find them, they encrypt all the files of those file shares too. So that's a really big problem and something that can be prevented. So what should you do during a malware incident? What's the first thing you should do? You're infected, or someone in your organization is infected by malware. So first thing is to figure out what is the indicators that you're looking for. Where are the malicious, what does the malicious files look like in your system? Where does it install itself? Usually it may be install several files and maybe edits your register settings and so on to be more persistent. So you need to know the indicators of the malware you're trying to get rid of. Also, once you have one infection, it's very often that there are more than one, that more users than just one clicked on this link, for instance, that the malware is such that it spreads itself. So you need to look for further infections. You should consider notifying the appropriate entities if you find a very strange and unknown malware. And this is something you can do, for instance, by looking up on VirusTotal, take a hash sum of the file of the malware and see if this is a common malware or if it's something that's really tailored and specific for me. In that case, it might be an APT or espionage malware, which is something you might want to work with the some other entities with. And then you can filter email to get rid of more malware coming in. You can update the signatures that you should look for and so on. And block, make blacklists and block lists. You might want to interrupt some services or take down some services. And also the same thing as with DDoS attack, look at your network and see if you can isolate the most critical parts of the network in case it's not infected yet, in case this is a worm that spreads itself, for instance. And of course, engaging the users, make the users aware of this new possibility of them being infected, and then that's a way of discovering more infections. when it comes to Windows, there's a lot of processes that you can look for. You can look for unusual behavior on your system, on your hosts, and search for unknown services, rogue processes, and unusual things that should not be on your system. This is a little bit like hunting for a bug or a threat, and can be a bit exciting to do. I actually recommend that you look into sans.org. They have a lot of posters, which this is part of one of the sans posters that will give you a good overview of what to look for when you handle malware incidents. If you're looking for malicious processes on your system, they usually try to make the malicious processes look a little bit like the normal processes that you would have running. For instance, they will look like almost spelled like a normal process. Sometimes it's executed in the wrong path, running under a wrong account could be something that would look suspicious, or it starts at unusual times, and also unusual command line arguments. It's possible to have automatic scanning tool looking for those types of things in the process too, but usually that's something that humans and analysts look for when they're investigating a malware incident. Oh, I'm concerned we're running out of time. I really want to do the Kahoot quiz. So let's see how much is left. You want to have the Kahoot quiz, yeah. So we have 10 minutes left, so I can switch to the Kahoot quiz. And I'll see if I can skip some of this so that we don't run out of time in the next lecture. Okay? So, just end this. Sound. Okay, so you may start joining the quiz. Is everybody in? Still waiting for some players? Short quiz. I think it's only 4 questions, so we should be finished in 5 minutes. And there's a chance of winning delicious chocolates. At least if you're in the room. Okay, we start. What is the phase after containment? That's eradication, getting rid of the problem. it's really close race. Shadow is leading. Name an incident response strategy. So there's two correct answers. Great. Loco for Shoko is leading. What is a chain of custody? That's a legal record that documents access to the evidence. Okay, last question, and we still have Loco for Shoko in the lead. It's really close though, so good luck everyone. What type of incident could be identified by these indicators? So that's a malware incident or unauthorized access. Okay, so let's see who's winning the chocolates. Loco for Shoko. Who is Loco for Shoko? Okay. Gratulerer. Ikke god. Okay, then we move into K105 and you continue the lecture there, quarter past.